Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. The American Civil Liberties Union has just obtained FBI documents detailing the surveillance of the Occupy movement, though the agency is still withholding the majority of that information. Quote, why does a political protest amount to a national security threat, asks the ACLU. Well, history may be a guide for us. Seth Rosenfeld has just written a book that took over 30 years of research and numerous lawsuits to produce. It's called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. It details how the FBI manipulated politics, media, careers, and individual lives in its quest to suppress the student movements at UC Berkeley. Ultimately, says Rosenfeld, this is a cautionary tale about the dangers of secrecy and power. Welcome to Your Call, Seth.
Pleasure to be here.
Seth Rosenfeld is a freelance journalist based in San Francisco and a correspondent with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He was also an investigative reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and San Francisco Chronicle and has won multiple awards, including the George Polk. His latest book, as I said, is Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. He will be speaking and signing books tonight at UC Berkeley at the Sibley Auditorium at 7 p.m. And you can find all of that information along with links to the book and articles at yourcallradio.org. And so, Seth, there's so much in this. It's a very thick book. It's a great read, but it's very chock full of information. So I believe you got 300,000 pages of FBI documents ultimately released over those decades.
Yes.
So let's start in 1960. The House Un-American Activities Committee held hearings at San Francisco City Hall on subversive activities in Northern California. Students were there. Police used fire hoses on these students. Can you just tell us what happened over those 3 days and why?
Yes. Well, the House Un-American Activities Committee was investigating alleged subversion in the field of education, and had subpoenaed a number of teachers from the Berkeley area and a student who at UC Berkeley to come and testify at this hearing. And on campus, the Daily Californian began to cover this impending hearing, and student interest was very heightened. So in May of 1960, when HUAC came to City Hall and set up its hearing inside the Board of Supervisors chambers, quite a few students at Berkeley and elsewhere wanted to come and see HUAC in action. They were curious. So they came to City Hall only to find that they were not admitted to the hearing because HUAC had stacked the hearing by issuing passes to people it considered to be friendly, such as members of the Daughters of the American Revolution and other conservative organizations. The students waited outside outside the Board of Supervisors chamber, patiently hoping to come in eventually, but over the course of 3 days, they were largely denied admission, and they began to chant and sing. And as a result of that, the San Francisco police used fire hoses to wash them down the City Hall rotunda, those wide marble steps in City Hall, and blasted them with these fire hoses and then arrested them. And J. Edgar Hoover saw this protest as a communist plot, part of a communist plot to attack HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and issued a sensational report called Communist Target Youth, which was widely distributed. Ultimately, more than 300,000 copies of his report were mailed out around the country and written up in newspapers. And according to J. Edgar Hoover's report, this whole riot was started by one Berkeley student named Robert Meisenbach, an English major,
whose life was almost ruined by this trial and his arrest.
Yes. Meisenbach was one of about 65 or so students who were arrested. All of them were charged with misdemeanors, which were soon dismissed, except for Meisenbach. He was the only one charged with a felony, the felony of assaulting an officer and starting this riot. So about a year went by before his trial finally happened, and there was great anticipation about this trial. It was seen not only as a test of whether he was guilty or innocent, but a test of whether J. Edgar Hoover's report claiming this was a communist plot was true or false.
And ultimately it was found to be false.
Meisenbach was acquitted at trial, And Hoover's report, which was founded on the claim that Meisenbach had started this whole riot, was found to be false. This had a very interesting effect. Hoover had tried to use the report to discredit the student activists and the critics of HUAC, but it had the opposite effect, because students could point to Hoover's report as falsely accusing them of being communists, when in fact they were just curious students who wanted to know how their government was operating.
So I'm looking forward to hearing from listeners who actually lived through this period, and we'll give out the number in just a minute. But in the meantime, can you paint a picture of this time in our history? There was this whole Cold War fear and approach to national security. Teachers and students were sort of targeted as potential communists. Tuition at the UC system at the time was free. Was there a legitimate fear like that the Lawrence Livermore lab would be infiltrated? What was going on here? What was the atmosphere?
Well, J. Edgar Hoover had long been concerned about the University of California. UC had helped develop the atomic bombs that were used to end World War II. And during the war and in the years right after, the Soviets were attempting to steal secrets from those nuclear labs. They were trying to do this through members of the local Communist Party. And the FBI discovered this in the early 1940s through a bug that had been placed in the Communist Party office in Oakland and in the home of a Communist Party official. And after the FBI obtained that intelligence, they mounted a massive investigation into the nuclear lab and possible Soviet espionage there. So Hoover was concerned about UC and communism at UC. And in the following years, what you see in the FBI files, however, is the FBI shifting its focus from this important national security mission of fighting espionage to focusing on professors and students who Hoover deemed to be too politically left or radical. And the FBI's power was used to gather files on them and to try and get so-called radical professors fired.
So there's really kind of four main characters in your book. Clark Kerr, the president of UC Berkeley, Mario Savio, the head of the free speech movement, at least for a time, Ronald Reagan, our former president and governor of California, and then, of course, Hoover in the shadows of this book. So let's talk a little bit about Mario Savio and what you found out about how extensive the FBI interference into his life was.
Savio is a fascinating figure. He was born in 1942 in New York City in a very devoutly Catholic family. He was raised to be a priest, and he believed he would be a priest when he grew up. But as he went through high school, he studied philosophy and science, and he began to question the dogma. Savio was a brilliant student. He had an IQ of 159, well above the genius level. He had a grade point average of 96.6. He was the valedictorian at his high school. He also had this debilitating stammer. When speaking in small groups of people, he just had the hardest time getting his words out. So after Savio graduated high school, he broke with his faith, but looked for another way to do good in the world. And he found that in the civil rights movement. He saw the civil rights movement as righting a terrible injustice, or trying to right that injustice. So Savio poured his energy into that, and in the summer of 1964 went to Mississippi as part of the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project to register blacks to vote. And while in Mississippi, Savio was attacked by members of the Ku Klux Klan, and his life was at risk. There were bombings. There were killings of other civil rights workers. When he returned to UC Berkeley in the fall of 1964, he was astonished to find out that there was a campus rule that prohibited him and other students from handing out leaflets on campus for any political cause, whether it was the civil rights movement or Goldwater for president. That year, the Republican National Convention was at the Cow Palace.
Here in San Francisco.
Yes. So the students were outraged about this. And One day, in defiance of this rule, they set up a card table in the middle of Sproul Plaza and began to hand out civil rights leaflets. No sooner had they done this than a campus police car pulled up right in the middle of the campus, and the police loaded, they arrested one of the men behind the card table and loaded him into the police car. But before they could drive away, students began to sit down around the car, and soon the plaza was filled with students sitting down around this car. They held the police car captive for the next 33 hours, and that's how the free speech movement was born at UC Berkeley in the fall of 1964.
Well, and that's some of the history that we already know, but what did the FBI documents reveal about how the FBI was surveilling and interfering with Savio's life?
Well, Hoover, who already had been suspicious of professors and students at UC Berkeley, saw the free speech movement as further evidence of a communist plot to disrupt the nation's campuses. And he ordered his agents to intensively investigate the free speech movement and Mario Savio and other leaders of the free speech movement. So among the FBI records released to me are more than 1,000 pages just on Mario Savio. These documents show that FBI agents investigated every aspect of his life and tracked his movements.
Even long after he was gone from Berkeley, he was no longer part of the free speech movement.
That's correct. Even after he was no longer politically active, FBI agents continued to collect information about him. Even after he found himself in a psychiatric hospital in the 70s, he had a period of homelessness and was hospitalized for a while, and the FBI agents still collected this information on him. Hoover had come to believe that Savio was a charismatic leader, correctly so, and was and had designated him as what the FBI called a key activist. This was somebody who was to be kept under especially close surveillance and, beyond that, targeted for disruption, meaning that their First Amendment activities were supposed to be obstructed secretly by the FBI.
So the other character in your book is Clark Kerr, and he was also targeted, like Savio, by the FBI, and yet he was a very different sort of a fellow. He was really a very moderate, an advocate of free speech and freedom of information and an advocate of the students, but a pretty conservative kind of liberal. Why was he so much in Hoover's crosshairs?
Well, Clark Kerr is also a fascinating character. He was born in 1911 in Pennsylvania. He grew up on a small farm, attended a one-room schoolhouse where a teacher took a special interest in him and helped him become a great student. And he got into Swarthmore College, where Kerr decided to become a Quaker. Kerr would later say that his experience at Swarthmore was transformative, that it opened his eyes to so many things. And when he became president of the University of California, he likewise tried to open the university to as many people as possible and to have as diverse a possible range of views reflected on the campus. So, for example, Kerr lifted the ban against communist speakers on campus. He also lifted the ban against politicians speaking on campus. Kerr wrote in his memoir that he was just chagrined that when Adlai Stevenson was running for president in the 1940s, that he couldn't actually stand on the campus and talk. He had to stand across the street and give a speech to the students listening on the lawn. So Kerr opened the campus to a wider range of ideas. J. Edgar Hoover viewed this as suspicious. He thought that Kerr had no business allowing communists to speak. Kerr had a very different view. He once said, the university is not engaged in making ideas safe for students. It's engaged in making students safe for ideas, meaning that if students were all well-educated, they would have the ability to hear any kind of viewpoint and reach a good conclusion on their own. He trusted them to do that.
And Hoover tried to get Kerr fired and actually presented false information to the Johnson administration when after he was ultimately fired from UC, the UC system, presented false information that made it so that he was not hired as the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare.
Hoover, over the years, came to view Kerr with more and more suspicion. for example, with the 1960 protest at San Francisco City Hall against HUAC, many conservatives demanded that Kerr punish the students who had participated in the protest there. And Kerr's response was, well, what the students do off campus is their business, and it's not the university's affair to punish them. This infuriated conservatives like Hoover, and these things accumulated. So when the free speech movement happened and Mario Savio emerged as a leader, Hoover was even angrier at Clark Kerr for not cracking down on Savio and the free speech movement. When Kerr was being considered as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under President Johnson, Johnson requested a background report on Clark Kerr. The FBI had a proper role in producing that background report, but as the courts later found in my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI abused that process and instead used it to undermine Clark Kerr by deliberately sending the White House a false report that contained allegations that Clark Kerr was associating with subversive people, even when the FBI had already investigated those allegations and knew they were false. Hoover also tried to get the Board of Regents to fire Clark Kerr. He leaked information to them, similar kinds of allegations. But the board at that time would not fire Clark Kerr. Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's father, was governor. He was a staunch supporter of Clark Kerr. And eventually the FBI concluded that as long as Pat Brown was governor, Clark Kerr would remain as president of the University of California.
And, you know, Kerr actually supported the exclusion of communists from faculty at UC Berkeley, right?
Clark Kerr did support the exclusion of communists. He signed the loyalty oath himself, and he supported the rule that prohibited communists from teaching at UC.
And yet he also supported people who didn't want to sign the loyalty oath.
He did. He believed that there was such a thing as an independent spirit, and that people had the principle, they had the right to refuse to sign the oath on principle, even if they weren't communists.
So talk about some of what was revealed in these documents that you got, the FBI's capacity to really intimidate and bully people, even with false evidence. How did that happen? What can you give some examples? And what was the scope? Like, how many people were involved?
Well, one of the things that astonished me in my research was the extent of the FBI's activities concerning the University of California. Hoover had built the FBI very much in his own image. He was the first director of it, and he presided over the FBI for 50 years. It was mostly white males of very conservative viewpoint who were FBI agents under his tenure. So they shared his viewpoints. And Hoover, through his great efficiency as a bureaucrat and his political viewpoint, was able to exert great influence on public policy by wielding his information, his secret files, sharing that information with people he saw as allies, or leaking the information to embarrass people he viewed as enemies.
And so we'll talk about Hoover's relationship with Ronald Reagan later. That's one of the big revelations in your book. One of the other big controversies, especially here in Northern California, is over the role of Richard Aoki, who was a well-known and well-respected member of several activist groups, including the Black Panthers. And in your book, you say that he was the person who supplied the Black Panthers with weapons and trained them. But the piece of information that comes out in your research and in your book is that you say that Aoki was an FBI informant.
Yes.
So this has been very controversial. Can you first tell us what is your evidence of that?
Right. Well, I first heard that Richard Aoki was an FBI informant when I was interviewing a retired FBI agent named Bernie Threadgill. I had been talking to Threadgill over a period of months and had multiple interviews with him, several hours long. Typically, what I would do is bring FBI documents that I had obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and to show them to Threadgill and discuss them. Well, one day I showed him a document without any prior notice, and he recognized Richard Aoki's name in it. And he said, oh, I know that guy. He was my informant. And I interviewed Bernie about this over the following weeks, and eventually obtained a very detailed statement from him about Richard Aoki and how he developed him as an FBI informant. This was an on-the-record statement. It was taped. But even so, I didn't consider that enough evidence to write about that. I needed more proof. So I began to research Richard Aoki. I had never heard of him prior to this. So I read everything I could find. I looked at court records. I interviewed people who knew him. And then in 2007, I interviewed Richard Aoki twice on the phone, about an hour each time. The interviews were taped with his permission. And in the second interview, I asked him if he remembered Bernie Threadgill. And his response was, "Who's that?" And I said, "Isn't it true that you used to work for the FBI?" And he said, "Who told you that?" I said, "Bernie did." And Richard said, "He did?" And I said, "Well, isn't this true?" And we talked back and forth, and he denied that he had been an FBI informant. But then as I pressed him further on this, he also said, "People change. It's very complex, layer upon layer." So when I wrote my book, I included not only his denial, but also this other statement, which I thought was very significant. Well, but that still wasn't enough evidence, and I did further research. After Richard Aoki died in 2009, I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request seeking any and all records on him. The FBI released around 1,800 pages, and one of the documents that was released identified him as informant T2. Now, I was quite sure of my interpretation of that because I had studied these records very closely over a long period of time. I'd been involved in 5 lawsuits with the FBI, and the courts had recognized my expertise in one of the opinions that were issued. But I wanted to double-check my interpretation still, so I consulted with another former FBI agent named Wesley Swearingen. Swearingen served in the FBI for about 25 years, and then became a critic of Hoover's operations. He wrote a book critical of the FBI and also helped vacate the murder conviction of a Black Panther named Geronimo Pratt on the ground that the FBI had failed to disclose that a key witness against Pratt had been an FBI informant.
So we'll continue with this, and I'm going to read a little bit of some of the criticism that's come out and have you speak to it. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with Seth Rosenfeld, who's the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. He'll be speaking and signing books tonight at UC Berkeley's Sibley Hall at 3 p.m. All of that information is at yourcallradio.org. And I want to invite listeners to join our conversation. If you want to talk about the Richard Aoki and that controversy or whatever you knew about it or involvement you had in it, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you were somebody who was involved in activism in Berkeley or anywhere else during the 60s, were you aware of the type of surveillance being done by the FBI at the time? What did you even suspect? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What national surveillance do you think is legitimate, if any? And if you're part of the Occupy movement, what are you seeing parallels between what was happening then and what's happening now? 866-798-8255 is the number to call. It's toll-free, 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
And you're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, manager of the station, here with Joe Burke, asking for your support for Your Call and KALW in this penultimate day of our fall membership campaign. The number to call is 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. And we do have Seth Rosenfeld's book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. I'm sure you've heard about it, seen his reporting on the cover of the San Francisco Chronicle. You can get the full story for a $120 contribution to KALW.
800-525-9917 or on online at KALW.org. There's another Your Call-related thank you gift we are offering for a $75 pledge. We will give you a pair of tickets to join us for election night coverage live from the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley, hosted by Rose Aguilar. Also, she'll be joined by longtime political analyst Larry Bensky, and we will invite you to join us, you and a friend, for a pledge of just $75.
800-525-9917. Your support keeps this station strong, and an independent voice like you hear on Your Call and your opportunity to take part in the conversation, you make it possible. 800-525-9917. And we do have a challenge, and that is from Elise Hall in Alameda.
Thank
She's
you, Elise.
A great supporter of the station, who said, I'm going to put forward $500, and I'm going to challenge 20 Your Call listeners to give their support in this hour. 800-525-9917.
30 minutes left before we wrap up today's Your Call, which, again, we are presenting in its entirety, even during a pledge drive. If we can get 20 calls in that 30 minutes, it's an extra $500, getting us ever closer to the goal of wrapping this drive as soon as we can. 800-525-9917.
KALW.org is great, too. That's where Marianne Johnston, a new member from San Mateo, went, and she said, I've listened for years. I'm finally clicking in with my support. KALW is my favorite. Your Call is fantastic, and ditto the show. Thank you, Marianne, for your support. Join her in keeping this local public radio station strong. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. We do have Seth Rosenfeld's book. For a $120 contribution, you can learn all about the FBI's surveillance during the Reagan administration here in California, before the Reagan administration took over the United States. 800-525-9917, online at KALW.org. And your support now can make an additional difference because of that challenge from Elise Hall in Alameda.
And that challenge is 20 callers before the end of your call this morning at 11 o'clock, and it's an extra $500 for local public radio. 800-525-9917, online, KALW.org. Join us on this, the second to the last day of our fall membership drive. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation with Martin Duberman about his recently released biography of Howard Zinn. It's called Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left. Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. This week we'll be talking about coverage of the teachers' strike in Chicago and in Egypt. And today we're asking the question, how and why did the FBI target and even destroy radicals at UC Berkeley in the 60s? We're speaking with Seth Rosenfeld, who's the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. Ultimately, says Rosenfeld, this is a cautionary tale about the dangers of secrecy and power. So what are your memories of activism in Berkeley in the 60s? Or if you're involved today, what's your experience? Have you noticed or suspected surveillance? You can call us at 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, right before the break, we were talking about a controversy in your book, Seth, which is about the role of Richard Aoki and the fact that your research shows that he was an informant. And here's just a couple of the criticisms that have been leveled at you. In the San Francisco Bay Guardian, Steve Wu and Alex Tom write, as Asian American activists in the movement today, we denounce these claims as baseless and false and are shocked at the way Rosenfeld makes such unsubstantiated claims while promoting his book release. And then it goes on to say that the agent, Barney Threadgill, is hardly a credible source and was a major player at the height of COINTELPRO. I will also read Diane Fugino writes that Rosenfeld has not met the burden of proof. He made definitive conclusions based on non-conclusive evidence. So go ahead and just respond to some of this criticism.
Sure. Well, first I should say that I can understand that many people who knew Richard Aoki or who knew of his reputation as a revered radical leader over the decades they're understandably shocked to find this out, that he was actually an FBI informant. And I understand also that some people are angry about this. But the critics who you just cited are not looking at the evidence. They're mischaracterizing the evidence. They're giving it short shrift. And I think when the dust settles, they're going to have to reappraise their view of Richard Aoki. Diane Fugino, I should mention, a professor at UC Santa Barbara, had published her own biography of Richard Aoki in April. And it's a glowing portrait of Richard Aoki. It's largely an oral history. She makes no mention whatsoever of his role as an FBI informant. So my research has revealed a rather gaping hole in her own book, and I think that partly explains why she has made such sharp personal attacks on me and mischaracterized my evidence. It should also be noted that Diane Fugino had one of the same FBI documents that I had, the one that identified Richard Aoki as informant T2. And when I asked her about that on KPF radio not long ago, she admitted that she had done nothing to study that record. She had consulted with no experts about it. She simply looked at it and decided it was insignificant. So I think there is a gap in her own scholarship that explains her personal attacks on my work.
So what I've heard, though, from some activists is that the FBI labeled a lot of people informants. They were talking to a lot of people. That doesn't necessarily mean that you were a traitor to the activism.
No, it doesn't mean that Richard Aoki was a traitor to the activism. And I never said that it did. I never said he disrupted any organization. What I've reported, what I've said precisely, is that Richard Aoki was a paid FBI informant at the time that he armed the Black Panthers in late 1966 and early 1967. And this is based on the totality of my research, which I describe in my book and in my notes to my book. And it's been confirmed since then with the release of additional records from Richard Aoki's informant file, which were the basis for a second story I did with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And if people are interested, they can actually read the entire informant file, which is posted at the center's website.
And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Although what it seems to imply is that Aoki arming the Panthers is what led to the eventual demise of the Panthers in many ways.
No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is the fact that he was a paid FBI informant at the time he provided weapons and firearms training to the Black Panthers, and the fact that the Panthers later had serious troubles involving firearms. Both Panthers and police officers were killed. And given the fact that J. Edgar Hoover saw the Panthers as posing the gravest threat to national security that time, and we know that he attempted to destroy the Panthers, that these facts together inescapably raise a certain question, which is, what did the FBI know, if anything, about Richard Aoki arming the Black Panthers, and did the FBI have any role in that? Now, I don't know the answers to those latter questions yet, but I think it's incumbent on the FBI to make a full disclosure of its relationship with Richard Aoki.
Do you see that as something that will happen? Do you have another FOIA request out?
Well, I'm still fighting with the FBI in court to release more information. The FBI took the position in court that it had no records on Richard Aoki himself. I challenged that, and one of the documents that I submitted as part of my challenge was a document that identified him as informant T2. Based on my challenge, the court reversed the FBI and ordered it to release additional records. And that was how we got the 200-odd pages of his informant file that were the basis for the second story, which confirms that Richard Aoki was a paid FBI informant.
And do you have any regrets about how you framed the story around Aoki, or do you feel like you stand by that?
I do stand by that.
Okay, let's go to some of our callers. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Krennan here with Seth Rosenfeld, who is the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. And if you were somebody who was a student activist or just a student during that time, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-798-8255. 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Do you want to say something, Seth?
Yes, I did. I think people looking at my book will see that there are four main characters: J. Edgar Hoover, Clark Kerr, Mario Savio, and Ronald Reagan. And it's through their narratives and tracing the FBI's activities with them that I tell the story of the FBI's activities at the University of California during the Cold War. But there are many other figures who I also write about. Richard Aoki is just one of those. They include Allen Ginsberg, Ken Kesey, many other people. When I discovered this information about Richard Aoki, I was skeptical about it. I went through extra steps, including a lawsuit, to get as much information as possible. I and my editors agreed that it was newsworthy information, and I felt I had a duty to report it.
And let's go to KDF in Oakland. Welcome to your call, KDF.
Hi. Thank you. I do have a question for Mr. Rosenfeld. I was at San Francisco State from 1964 to 1968, and I did work with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And something that I always admired from the very first day that I was on the San Francisco State campus was there was a quad, a large gathering area right outside of where people ate. And on the quad was always a microphone plugged in. And it didn't matter if you were a student or not. It didn't matter if you were a communist or a Republican. It didn't matter at all. All you had to do was to take your turn, walk up to the microphone, and say whatever you wanted to say. And so I was wondering if in his research, Mr. Rosenfeld came across that fact, and if that motivated the free speech movement because the kids at Berkeley wanted what we had at San Francisco State.
Mm. Well, my book focuses on UC, so I didn't explore that very interesting aspect of San Francisco State. The free speech movement actually won the right for free speech for students to engage in full constitutional activities on campus in 1964, and I think that may have actually preceded the period that you're mentioning.
No, because that microphone being plugged in and available to everyone existed even before I came to San Francisco State. It existed in 1960, 1961, and so on.
Well, great to find out about that.
Very interesting.
Thank you so much, KDF. Really appreciate it. Let's go next to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to your call.
Hi, thank you. So I just wanted to make a brief comment. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I'm one of about six or seven attorneys who are appointed to represent several criminal defendants involved in the Occupy movement who are currently charged with trespassing. And I just recently found out that there were apparently FBI documents. I guess they're focused on the Occupy movement in Oakland.
Yeah.
The main comment I want to make is that while there are six or seven folks who are currently charged in San Francisco, it's out of about 100 people who were arrested, which, being a natural-born skeptic, leads to the question, how many folks that were there when these arrests took place are actually involved in being informants, whether paid, whether they're undercover cops, so on and so forth. Just because if you take 100 people and you arrest them and you only charge six or seven, when they're all accused of doing the same thing, it raises a few questions.
Yes, stay on the line, Chris. Let's. What are the parallels between what happened then and what's happening now? And what does what happened in the 60s and that surveillance tell us about what's happening or might be happening now?
Well, what we saw in the 60s is that the FBI used the powers it had been granted to protect the country against foreign threats. It took those powers and turned them against citizens involved in First Amendment activities and people engaged in dissent. And the parallel to now is that once again there are various protest movements such as Occupy. We see police and intelligence agencies like the FBI gathering information about them. And that raises a question, why are these agencies doing that? What is the purpose and how are they using that information?
And Chris, have you done a Freedom of Information Act to find out what's happening? I think you're down in Santa Cruz, or you're representing clients in Santa Cruz?
Well, it's in a criminal case, you have a right to what's called discovery. And you normally you go through the district attorney for that. And we have a somewhat of a pitched battle going on this afternoon, in fact, over what we consider a selective prosecution in an attempt to figure out why they've decided only to charge a handful of people when they've done what you can only consider a mass arrest. And so far the pushback has been, well, some of that's privileged and confidential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea behind a criminal case is you're entitled to almost everything, so there's no surprises. So when you have a case involving First Amendment rights and involving a political movement, and you have the district attorney claiming that there's some sort of privilege going on, you got to scratch your head. I mean, it's not like an undercover cop buying drugs off someone from a location they don't want to reveal. This is classic First Amendment issues, and now we're being forced into fighting over something that we believe we're entitled to. So that's the long answer. The short answer is a FOIA request would take even longer.
Right. Right. Hey, Chris, we have been thinking about potentially doing a show on this, so can you just stay on the line, and our producer will get your number, and let's go back to, this is Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with Seth Rosenfeld, who's the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. You can join our conversation. We just have a few more minutes left. 866-798-8255. The toll-free number again is 866-798-8255. And here's a couple of comments from listeners. Susan Brown writes, in 1965, while a student at Berkeley, I purchased a button that said Freedom Under Clark Kerr. Do you have any comment on how Kerr became also to be seen as the enemy by students?
Yes.
I've got some more emails, too, so let's kind of go through this stuff fast.
Kerr was the man in the middle. On the one hand, he had J. Edgar Hoover and other conservatives who saw him as too soft on student protesters. On the other side, he had the free speech movement and leaders like Mario Savio, who saw him as a bureaucrat who simply wouldn't acknowledge their constitutional rights.
And here's two other comments. Really fascinating document released on September 7th, 2012, quashes all criticisms of Rosenfeld's work with facts and a myriad of relevant documents. Critics need to reevaluate their perception of the informant Aoki and the excellent reporting of Rosenfeld. Another comment says, when the FBI claims the Panthers were the greatest threat, it was not for their guns. It was for their breakfast and community service programs, some of which were much later instituted by the state of California and the federal government itself. Any comment on that?
Yes. Well, Hoover saw the Panthers as a threat for a variety of reasons. We know from congressional studies and Freedom of Information Act requests that he took extraordinary measures to try and disrupt and neutralize them.
So there's so much in this book, but to me the biggest revelations were about Ronald Reagan, and who is an extremely popular politician, both posthumously and during his time. So what surprised you most about what you found out about Ronald Reagan's connection to J. Edgar Hoover, their very close relationship, and his work as an FBI informant?
Mm. I was surprised to find that Ronald Reagan was more involved as an FBI informant and had a much more significant relationship with the FBI over the decades than we previously knew. His earlier biographers had written in their books, I'm thinking of people like Gary Wills, Ann Edwards, Edmund Morris, of their frustration with the few number of pages that had been released on him from the FBI and the heavy redactions within them. So as a result of my lawsuits, we obtained more than 10,000 pages of records on Ronald Reagan, and these provide the most complete picture to date of his involvement with the FBI. I believe these records show that the FBI played a key role in Ronald Reagan's political development, his turning from what he has described as a liberal Democrat in Hollywood to a staunch anti-communist. These records show that Reagan was more involved as an informant, that he named his fellow actors, he secretly named opponents within the Screen Actors Guild, and that later Hoover repaid his efforts by doing personal and political favors for him.
Yeah, it's too much for us to get to. The book is called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. Our guest is Seth Rosenfeld. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We've got not too much time and a number of callers. I'm going to just kind of go through the callers and then get your comments afterwards. Let's go first to Philip in Oakland. Hi, Philip.
How you doing?
Fine. You say you knew Huey Newton?
I didn't know him well. I went to school with his wife, Frederica Newton. I succumbed to a lot of the things that Huey succumbed to, and I was I justified a lot of my political and criminal lifestyle as a young man. I was a semi. I was too cowardly to be a true Black Panther, but I did my own job. It was a tumultuous time. But I'd like to ask the gentleman who wrote the book, The Subversives, did he see the movie Panther, and does he have any feedback about the Oakland being inundated with drugs as an effective remedy? You get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, let me see if I understand it, because I want to go through the other callers before we get response. Saying that the drugs were potentially...
I've heard the movie Panther says that, and I was here, and I'm, you know, there's a bumper sticker I saw that says, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. Okay, there were a lot of drugs that came. And Huey was effectively killed because of drug-related stuff.
Gotcha. Okay, so we'll get a response in just a minute, Philip. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Guy in Oakland. Hi, Guy.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I was just calling because I was part of the Occupy movement in Oakland and a couple other places for a while. And I noticed that there was a lot of distrust around who was an informant and who was an infiltrator. And it was very hard to build cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if Seth Rosenfeld had any comments about how current movements can confront that reality.
Thank you. That's a great, great question. And Jonathan in Marin, very quickly, just because we're running out of time.
In the era of drones, do we have different concerns about being surveilled if we're activists? And how will future journalists get documents if they're collected by non-humans?
Got it. Okay, so let's get... We just have a couple of minutes left, Seth. Just kind of final thoughts. The mistrust question, I think, is the biggest one.
Yes. I think there are some lessons for today's activists from the 60s. The free speech movement had a credo of operating openly and being very democratic and being nonviolent. And that was one way that infiltrators were, that was one way that the free speech movement inoculated itself against infiltrators, because by operating openly, they were less susceptible to manipulation, and by eschewing violence, they couldn't be entrapped into committing violent crimes that could be used against them. I think that ultimately the book is a cautionary tale and a warning against the dangers of secrecy and power. Today's FBI is very different than J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. There's much more accountability. Bob Mueller is a very different director than J. Edgar Hoover was. But nonetheless, there is this concentration of power and secrecy that is necessary for the FBI to operate, but at the same time inherently poses potential risks to democracy. And it's incumbent on citizens to and lawmakers to remain vigilant about that.
And in something like Occupy, do you think that surveillance is justified?
Well, it can be justified. This is very specific to the facts of any given protest. If a protest is blocking certain things, or if there's a threat of violence, the police have some responsibility. The FBI may, under the circumstances, conceivably have some responsibility. But the question is, do they go beyond the line?
And your book clearly finds that they did go beyond the line.
And yes, it does.
And so do you think that that's happening today? What's your advice for activists? And we just have a few seconds, but...
My advice to activists is to operate openly and with nonviolence, and to be aware of potential surveillance and infiltrators and provocateurs, and to use their legal remedies to redress any kinds of abuses that they think are happening.
Well, I'm very sorry that we have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Seth Rosenfeld, who's the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. And Seth will be speaking and signing books tonight at UC Berkeley at the Sibley Auditorium at 7 p.m. He'll also be at Litquake later in October. And you can find more information about the book, about his speaking engagements, and links to articles and documents at yourcallradio.org. And we'll, you can also post comments there and continue this conversation. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Thanks for your calls and emails. And I'm Holly Kernan, and thank you for joining us.
And I'm Matt Martin, joining Holly here in Studio B here in KALW. Just a few minutes to ask for your support at the end of your call. We have a challenge. 20 calls or clicks. Elise Hall in Alameda, a generous supporter of the station, says,
thank you, Elise.
If 20 people support your call today, she will put an additional $500 into KALW's coffers. You have already started responding. 10 people have already given their support to KALW this hour. Be the next person who can help put us over the top.
1-800-525-9917. We are doing these no interruption drives, but we need you to respond. I know how much people love your call. Everybody's always coming up to me and saying, I love Rose Aguilar. I do too. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call right now. We are at the end of our pledge drive here, and this is the time to show your support for your call. And we have Seth's book to send to you as a thank you gift. It's Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. It's amazing. It's history, but it's also written like a mystery. And we will send you this as a thank you when you call.
800-525-9917. It's yours for a $120 contribution. I mean, this right here, this book, this is local history, right? If you want, we're local public radio. If you want to understand what's happening in this area, what the history that the politics of this place came out of, you want to read Subversives. And of course, it had national and global impact. Your support at 800-525-9917, or you can go online to KALW.org, where you can learn more about other thank you gifts, learn about this station. It makes a difference now. We want to wrap up this campaign as a success without interrupting the programming. You make it possible.
And we have a challenge, right?
That's right.
Tell us about the challenge again.
20 calls or clicks in this hour. Now, we've already had 10 people get involved. If we make it to 20, Elise Hall is a listener in Alameda, will put up $500 more. If we don't make it to 20, we don't get that support. We have to offer it back to Elise.
We will make it. We will make it. 1-800-525-9917, or just go online, klw.org. There's lots of thank you gifts there. We don't take a lot of time talking about that because we're doing no interruption drives. The drive is at its end. This is probably your last opportunity to support your call that brings you these kind of conversations every single day. And we'll send you this book, Subversives, by Seth Rosenfeld. It's fantastic local history that tells us so much about what's happening today. 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org. We have literally seconds, Matt, to get 10 people, probably 5 more people right now, to go to the phone or to go online to klw.org.
800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. In a conversation like today, you want to have the phone lines open because the people who are at Sproul Plaza in the 1960s are listening, because the Occupy activists, their lawyers, are listening. We want to bring that conversation together with the great information that Seth Rosenfeld has from his research. Your support makes that kind of conversation possible.
We're getting really close to our goal, Matt. I think we need just a few more people to call.
Thanks to the folks who are on the line. We do have an open line.
1-800-525-9917. We are seconds away. We need to make this goal. KALW.org. We would love to send you, as a thank you gift for a pledge of $120 or above, Seth Rosenfeld's book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. KALW.org.
800-525-9917.
One open line.
$120 will get you that book. But at any level of support, you will help us make this challenge and you will keep this public radio strong. That's what we're about doing here. One person at a time taking part. We've had people give $25 today. We've had people give $500 today. You come in at the level you can. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
And thank you.